You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, Dave Fettig talks with Jim Heinen, author of The Youngest Boy. He grew up on an Iowa farm in one of the last areas in the state to get electricity. He attended a one-room schoolhouse and wrote a popular book about the experience. His other works include The Man Who Kept Cigars in His Cap and You Know What Is Right. He was formerly writer-in-residence at St. Olaf College in Northfield and received numerous awards for his writing. He lives in St. Paul. Then, in the last part of the hour, Liz Olds talks with Sophronia Scott, a novelist, essayist, and lead contemporary thinker whose work has appeared in Time, People, Q, the Oprah Magazine, and numerous other outlets. She was nominated for the Best New African American Literary Award. She holds degrees from Harvard and the Vermont College of Fine Arts. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Hello, Jim, are you there? Hello, Jim, this is Dave, and we got to push the button. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Welcome to Right on Radio on KFAI. How are you doing tonight?
Doing great. I'm actually sitting overlooking Discovery Bay in Puget Sound.
Well, that sounds nice.
I'm a little bit out of my element.
I'm overlooking Cedar Riverside, so you got me beat tonight.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. That's true. That's the right attitude. Say, congratulations on the book, Jim, and on your marvelous career. Before we start with the reading, why don't you tell us a little bit about how this book fits into your catalog, as they say?
Well, I didn't know it was going to happen, but one day I got an idea to write from the youngest boy's perspective. And as a matter of fact, I know the exact date from my notebook was December 15, 2019.
Wow.
So it was right at the beginning of the pandemic. And then in January, as the pandemic took hold, I just isolated and kept writing these youngest boy stories, and they just kept pouring out.
Wow.
And I had gotten an invitation from this small press in Minnesota, Holy Cow Press, in which the publisher asked me, if you ever have another boy collection, please send it to me. So I did.
Yeah.
And he took it.
Wonderful. We love Holy Cow Press and Jim up there. That's great. Well, you certainly kicked it out in a hurry, but I'll let the readers know before we get a reading from you that the book is it's lovely. It's small. The chapters, the passages, the vignettes, whatever we're going to call them, are brief and very brief. I want to talk with you about that a little more in detail. But it's also illustrated, and delightfully so, I might add, by Tom Port. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's just a charming
Tom Port from Michigan.
Yeah, it's a charming book, and we're going to talk more about that also. But let's kick it off with a reading so our delightful listeners can get a sense for what you're up to.
Okay. I'll start out with one called Chicken Salad Crunchies. The youngest boy has a little bit of an inferiority complex, especially when it comes to older kids and city kids.
Okay.
And this one is, when the cousins from the city visited the farm, the first thing the youngest boy noticed was their teeth. They had nice teeth, straight, white as the keys on the church organ. When these cousins smiled, all of those teeth were not just perfectly white, but the top and bottom teeth lined up with each other like two straight rows of corn with their leaves leaning over and fitting together beautifully. And their teeth had no gaps between them like the gaps between his own teeth. And none of his cousins had buck teeth like so many farm kids. The youngest boy didn't have buck teeth, but a couple of his teeth left gaps big enough to hold a kernel of corn where it would stay until he went after it with a fork or his fingernail. All those nice teeth didn't bother the youngest boy nearly so much as the fact that the city cousins were so proud of them. Why couldn't they keep their mouths shut instead of smiling to advertise their teeth? Show off teeth. Look what I've got that you don't have teeth. Their teeth were so nice that they didn't even look real. Real things never look this nice. His cousin's teeth were so nice that they were disgusting. When sandwiches were being prepared for these city cousins, The youngest boy slipped away and got a handful of gravel from the driveway. He put a couple of tiny pebbles into all the sandwiches except the one he would be eating. His cousins would be getting the chicken salad crunchies. As his cousins chomped down on their sandwiches, there were some little snapping sounds. People with such nice teeth had to show good manners to measure up to the looks of their teeth. But nice teeth and good manners couldn't hide what was happening in their mouths as they politely chewed on their chicken salad crunchies. The looks on their faces were somewhere between being scared and being ready to cry from the pain. Fair was fair. Those little bits of gravel were going a long way towards evening the score in the teeth department.
Thank you, Jim. That was Jim Hanen reading from The Youngest Boy. So Jim, the youngest boy, this is how he's referred to. I'm going to ask you if this is you, of course. I'm assuming that it is. And if so, or if not, why did you choose to use this third-person point of view instead of the...
Well, you know, I'd like to say, well, it wasn't me. You know, I certainly feed him lots of information because I grew up at the same time in the same place that he did. But I feel more like I discovered this character out there, and he came to me and asked to be written about, so I did.
Oh, I love that.
He remembered me in any way. It's just one of these weird coincidences.
Yeah, yeah. These stories are really, they feel personal. It almost feels like a memoir, but of course it's not written as a memoir. These come from memory, these stories?
Well, some of the information of what makes them possible come from memory, but, you know, none of this happened to me.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
I never did that, for example. I did resent people who thought they were better than we were.
Of course.
But these are fantasies.
I'm glad to hear you never put gravel in someone's sandwich, Jim. That makes me feel better.
Not yet.
So, Jim, I grew up in North Dakota, not on a farm, but I have many relatives who lived on a farm, and we visited quite frequently. And this life that's described in the book, it feels like it's gone pretty much. Tell me if you think that's right, and if so, are you writing about something that's missing? Is this a reminder of what life used to be like? It doesn't feel like it's nostalgic necessarily, but you're trying to tell people about a way of life that used to be. At least that's how I feel.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, it's a recalling what it's been lost, some of it good riddance. Yeah. Some of it, I think, would make our hearts ache a little bit. Well, but yeah, that era is gone. I mean, you go to the farm now, it's a very different scene.
What have we lost with that? For example, I knew about farm life only from visiting, but at least I knew about it. My kids know almost nothing, and many kids of their generation know almost nothing, and so on and so forth. Are we losing anything because of that?
Well, from my perspective, we are losing the oral tradition of storytelling that was so common among farmers. And my main inspiration for the boy stories was an old man who would go to his little shed in the grove every night to wash eggs. And people would come around because he was such an interesting character who liked to tell stories. So while he was washing eggs, he would tell stories.
Wow.
And he, you know, he was sort of the prime example for me in early inspiration because I would see how much people would laugh at his stories and we never knew what was true and what wasn't true.
Right.
He was the man who kept cigars in his cap.
Mm-hmm. What?
And I had a whole book typed by that title.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. What was your relationship, and then maybe we can talk about and get a story from you about the youngest boy's relationship with the farm animals. I always found it to be a complex sort of thing with farmers and farm kids especially, who grew fond of certain animals, even though they knew that their time was coming in the fall generally. And the book deals very directly with, you know, these sorts of issues. slaughtering animals and loving them at the same time.
Right. When I think back, probably one of the most painful memories is what I would see being done to animals. And of course, as a little boy, you emulate the men, mm-hmm. and the men are doing these terrible things to animals, and then you realize you don't really identify with the men, you identify with the animals.
Interesting.
And then as an adult, when you write about these real things that happen to animals, the danger you run is that people would think you approve of cruelty to animals. No, not at all, but mm-hmm. I am going to tell the truth about how they were treated.
Yeah. Jim, there are a number of stories that deal with this topic. Do you want to read one for us?
Dealing with animals? Yes. Yeah. I like this one called Betsy's Cat.
There you go. Good.
Sometimes it was surprising what the men and older boys didn't notice. That day, they didn't notice that old Betsy was acting like she was about to have her calf. Her middle looked as if it had a giant balloon inside, and she was looking back over her shoulder as if she was trying to figure out where some kind of ache was coming from. Most times when a cow looked like she was getting ready to have her calf, the men locked her up in a small pen in the cow barn where they could watch her and maybe help her have her calf if things got tough. That's what happened last time Betsy had a calf. It took two older boys to pull that calf out. This morning, Betsy didn't walk with the other cows out to the pasture. She headed off on her own in the direction of this big dip in the middle of the pasture. It was a place the youngest boy knew well, because the grass was taller in the dip, and if you sat down, you'd be all by yourself with nothing but all that grass, tall grass and butterflies around you. That's exactly where Betsy headed. When he started to follow her, Betsy looked back. She didn't like the youngest boy's attention, so he hid behind the fence until she got where she was going. He gave her some time and then walked over to the tall grass where Betsy was lying on her side and giving some big heaves to get the calf out of her. The youngest boy walked behind her to see how things were going. It would be fun if he would be the only person here when the calf was born, but he'd run to get the men and older boys if he saw that Betsy was having too much trouble. Betsy wasn't having any trouble with this one. The little front hooves were already out, and the calf's nose between them, it looked as if the calf was diving into the world. And then in one big slithery whoosh, there the calf was, slimy and beautiful in the tall grass. The youngest boy felt like telling Betsy what a good job she had done, but Betsy was trying to stand up to see what had just happened. The calf's eyes were open. It was breathing, and it was trying to stand up too. Betsy and her calf stood up at the same time and looked at each other. Betsy walked over to what she had just done, sniffed her calf, and licked it behind the ears. The youngest boy saw that the legs of the calf and Betsy were shaking. He looked down. His legs were shaking too.
That's great. Thanks, Jim. That's Jim Hanen reading from his newest collection, The Youngest Boy. That was Betsy's Calf. Boy, I tell you what, Jim, if you didn't live on a farm, I don't know how you could have pulled these off. Tell us a little about your experience growing up.
Well, I lived in, my family lived in one of the last areas of Iowa to get electricity. So the early years of my life, we didn't have electricity, mm-hmm. and we didn't have any central heating. I grew up in a cold farmhouse in northwest Iowa.
Wow.
And it meant, I may have written about this sometimes, but when sows would have baby pigs in the middle of the winter, mm-hmm. and it was terribly cold, my father would put them in this big metal basket and with straw on the bottom and take it in the house and put it on our wood cook stove to warm up the pigs before taking them back to the sow in the barn, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We would have we didn't have any pipes in the house to freeze, but the water sometimes in the supply tank would freeze.
Yeah.
So in retrospect, it looked like a really tough life, but everybody was living like that in that neighborhood. So nobody could say this is tough. We all made it, but yes, it was very, very different, very cold. My brother and I would take our clothes and put them under the blankets with us when we went to bed at night to get the clothes warm so we wouldn't have to get into cold clothes on the cold floor when we got up in the morning. All of this stuff sounds kind of weird today, but that was the life. It was everybody's life,
yeah.
So you couldn't complain.
Yeah, yeah. And you've written about, of course, one-room schoolhouse, and that comes up in your book. How long did you attend rural schools?
8 years.
Okay.
Graduated from grade school at the age of 12.
Well, look at you. Advanced.
Yeah, I look at you. Which meant that I graduated from high school when I was 16.
Wow.
Which meant that I graduated from college when I was 20.
Boy.
So even though there may have been disadvantages in early youth, you know, mm-hmm. at least I got kicked along pretty fast.
Yeah, yeah. Say, Jim, do you write poetry?
Yes, I started out as a poet.
Okay, because I can tell. There's a lot.
Yeah, my first publications were poetry.
Okay.
And then I started seeing some things that in which poetry and fiction seemed to be almost a marriage. And I was inspired by Swampy Cree naming songs. Hmm. And publication I saw, it was written in lines like poetry, but the voice was so much like the storytelling voice of the best storytellers in the community where I grew up.
Mm.
My first collection of poems was with Copper Canyon Press.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Poetry, indeed.
Venerable publisher of poetry. Say, since we're dropping names of publishers and things like this, I have to mention, I was really impressed with the blurb you got at one point from Raymond Carver.
Oh, yes.
And that's pretty impressive. How did you...
I got to know Ray, and I got to know Ray through his knowing my writing, which was wonderful. And I have to thank Tess Gallagher, who was finally his wife before he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in Port Angeles while I was living in Port Townsend, and we got together very, very often.
Wow.
there's one story. He actually stole a story from me.
Yeah.
Not stealing. The way writers steal from each other.
Sure.
But in Port Townsend, Washington, where I am right now, this is where I lived for many years.
I see.
I'm new to Port Townsend, Washington right now, visiting old friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I was walking down the street in Port Townsend, and next to a lawn that was trimmed just beautifully, but on that manicured lawn was this enormous fish.
Fish.
Like, 20 inches, 24 inches long, lying on that, on the grass there.
Okay.
And I looked up and there were two eagles circling overhead. And I looked at them and I said, okay, this isn't my fish. So I walked away and I went down to Fort Warden State Park where Centrum Foundation is, and it's actually where Copper Canyon Press is too. And I told that story, what had just happened to me. Oh, Raymond Carver was there, and he heard that story. And you probably can find that Raymond Carver poem somewhere about how he sees this big fish and he picks it up and eats it.
Thank you for that story. Tell us, Jim, about the illustrations, and why you decided to have them there. Were they your idea? Were they Holy Cow's idea?
It was my idea, but the story of Tom Port goes back a long, long way to when I was teaching at the University of Michigan in Flint.
Mm.
And I was teaching in a special program called the Challenge Program, which was for underachieving high school students a summer program. They wouldn't be able to get into the University of Michigan unless they took this challenge program to sort of get them up to speed, to get their work to match their brains. Mm-hmm. And Tom Port was one of those students, and he sat in that class, and I think he wrote quite well, but he really preferred to write, to draw the pictures to go along with what he wrote. So I met him as a high school student.
Wow.
And then when Grey Wolf Press did the first collection of my stories, the Man Who Kept Cigars in His Cap, they used Tom Port. And Tom Port, but that was sort of a kickoff book for him. Mm. It wasn't long after that book came out that Gary Snyder solicited Tom Port to illustrate one of his books. And then Barry Lopez notably asked Tom Port to illustrate the national bestseller Crow and Weasel, which was really, you know, sent Tom Port's reputation skyrocketing. And but he never left me, and I haven't left him.
Okay, wow. Yeah. So, Jim, I just was mumbling and stumbling to myself because we're actually getting close to the end of our call, and I can't believe it. And I have so many other questions. So tell us what you're working on next. Let's do that before we run out of time.
Well, I just, during the pandemic, I also wrote a novel that my agent loves, and it's called The Last One-Room Schoolhouse in Iowa.
Yep.
And it actually focuses on a student who graduates from there. Not me, but, you know, the front of graduate from it. And the teacher who's only like 5 years older than he is. And this was not uncommon in those one-room schoolhouses. There are actually cases where a person would teach in a one-room schoolhouse who had not had 1 hour of college education. They were just big readers.
Wow.
And the requirements for teachers didn't come until the 50s, I guess.
Wow.
But, this novel is inspired by, in part, the one-room schoolhouse teacher.
I see.
And then it becomes a love story.
It sounds a little racy, Jim. Am I right?
It is pretty racy, actually.
All right, now
it's the raciest thing. It's the raciest thing I've ever written.
Well, make sure that I get a copy of that. Make sure I get a copy of that, and we'll have you back on the show, okay?
Yeah, I hope it gets taken sometime in the next half year. I think publishers are very slow right now to respond to new writing.
Yeah.
One can only hope that the people making decisions in editorial offices are people with literary quality, you know, are looking at the literary quality rather than looking at the marketability.
Well said. I agree. We all agree with you here on Right on Radio. Thank you, Jim. This is Jim Hanen and is talking about his new book, The Youngest Boy. Jim, it's been a pleasure. I have to let you go.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll talk to you again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Sophronia, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hi, how are you today?
Hello, I'm fine.
Oh, welcome to Right on Radio, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
This is Sophronia Scott, author of The Seeker and the Monk, and many other books. Why don't we start with you reading and giving us a bit of information about the book, maybe before you do the reading.
Okay. Well, The Seeker and the Monk, Everyday Conversations with Thomas Merton, is about my engagement with the journals of the monk, the Trappist monk, Thomas Merton. He wrote extensive journals that were published under the stipulation that they not come out until 25 years after his death. So these are really the unvarnished Merton. And it's basically almost like a conversation between the two of us where I glean advice and his observations about the world and how I learned from him from reading these journals.
And I see you have a reading, putting the glasses on there.
Yes, I am. So the portion I'm going to read for you is from the chapter called The Hermione Granger of Gethsemane, How to Pray. And this particular section is called How to Soar. And there's a quote in Merton's journal where he is saying, quote, "I have my fingers too much in the running of my own life. I put myself into God's hands and take myself out again to readjust everything to suit my own judgment. Jesus, I put myself in your hands. Promise to stop jumping out of your arms to try and walk on my own feet, forgetting that I am no longer on the ground or near it. Why do I mistrust your goodness, mistrust everyone but myself, meet every new event on the defensive, squared off against everybody from my superiors on down," unquote. Oh, Thomas, may I suggest an answer? Perhaps because of your cloistered existence, you haven't had enough opportunities for experiences in which you clearly see or feel God at work in your life. You have nothing to feed your faith, and instead you subsist on books. You're like the Hermione Granger of Gethsemane. Hermione, one of Harry Potter's best friends in the popular book series by J.K. Rowling, is called the cleverest witch of her age. She pushes herself to excel in magic by studying hard. She reads loads of books, knows a vast array of spells, and can cast them with immense focus and power. Yet she struggles with magic that requires a more intuitive sense, such as divination or even flying on a broomstick. When Harry tells her he's not as good at magic as she is, she admits her own magic is limited, based only on books and cleverness. She knows there are interior characteristics that make a wizard powerful, characteristics she recognizes in Harry. I'll put it this way, Thomas. You don't know how to soar. Here's what I mean. Like you, I pray. My prayer is often an ongoing soundtrack, a conversation without ceasing. At times, it is specific and intercessory. But then there are times of trial when I can sense my life is on the cusp of tremendous loss and suffering. And what do I hear in those times? Nothing. And I mean nothing. From either side, I don't feel impelled to send out words into the universe, and I feel nothing but a silent void acting as an answer. This happened the night when I lie in bed in the dark, knowing I would hear in the morning whether or not my sister Theo had overcome the infection that was shutting down her organs. In those dark hours, I could not pray. This used to perturb me. I wondered if I had been abandoned, for my sister did die. What was I to make of the heartbreaking loss? Did the awful thing happen because God had forsaken me? I discussed this once with the rector of our church, and she told me this sense of not being able to pray was normal. She said, those are the times when you have others pray for you. For a few years, I accepted her explanation. I would contact a few close friends and ask them to pray for me. But in another of those voids of silence, this one, as I stood in the hall of a New York City hospital while Katie, a dear friend I loved as a sister, underwent surgery, and I waited to hear whether or not she had cancer, a realization came over me. How do I describe it? It felt like I was waiting in a quiet, open space. Then an image came to me, that of an eagle soaring. I thought of the powerful quiet of gliding through air. I asked myself this question: What if all my previous prayers, especially the specific practices in church or in my prayer spaces at home, were the equivalent of a large bird flapping its wings in preparation for flight? Then, in times of trial, when I think I cannot pray, perhaps that's when I have somehow taken off. I'm supposed to glide, be present, trust the current of air, of spirit, to uphold me so I can do what is necessary in the crisis. Gliding is silent. Gliding is strong. God turns down the noise and lifts me, letting me know you can do this. You are not alone. Instead of an absence of prayer, I am surrounded by prayer, effortless prayer. But I don't know how this works, so I don't know if I can teach it. Thomas, I feel as though you would ask me if you should study aerodynamics. Should we discuss prayer in terms of drag and thrust, lift and weight? Maybe I will remind you of your words from Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander about the birds who each morning, quote, manifest themselves as birds, beginning to sing. Presently, they will be fully themselves and will even fly, unquote. But in your cloistered life, you haven't been forced out of a tree to give you the chance to test your wings. You can't trust them because you haven't had the full experience of them. I suggest you only need to remember that flight is in your nature.
Thank you. That was so, oh man. Sophronia Scott, sorry about that. Reading from her book, The Seeker and the Monk. You know, I had a lot of questions, and I was going to save this one for last, but I think it would be wonderful to get you to talk about the two different things you talk about, the immortal wound and the impossible world. And those things seem to connect to me, even though we're in very different parts of the book. I was wondering if you could maybe talk about those two things and how they connect, if they do connect for you.
Well, the immortal wound is something I learned from the writer Robert Vivian in a lecture where he talked about how we all have these immortal wounds, something that has happened to us that we can never get over. And somehow as artists, they show up in everything we create. And his example was Tennessee Williams, the playwright, and how he never got over his sister's lobotomy. And in one way or another, that is always in his writing, even if it doesn't seem like he's writing about that. So you're referring to my chapter on race, where I talk about my immortal wound being feelings of betrayal, mm-hmm. of that someone would not see me as lesser than, right? And so that's the immortal wound. And the impossible world is, I guess you could say, if you want to tie the two together, it's trying to love the world despite that wound showing up in ways large and small, and somehow believing that there is good in the world, as much as things happen to make you not want to believe that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does make sense. And it kind of brings me, I'm just thinking of kind of the sort of mystical things that you talk about. The Rumi quote is a quote that I really, really love. It is, out beyond the ideas of right and wrongness, there is a field. I will meet you there. And the whole book seems to be about this quote that you're meeting us in a certain place. And you're also bringing Thomas Merton to us in a certain way. And I feel like maybe you could speak to that, how you feel about that.
Well, I think one of the reasons I ended up writing this book is because I had been asked a lot of questions about about how to engage with Merton. I was at the Festival of Faith and Writing, and I was on a panel about Thomas Merton. And I confessed right up front, I said, you know, I'm not a theologian, I'm not an academic, I'm just someone who, I kind of have this monk who follows me around and he gives me advice. And people seem to be really hungry to know how that works, you know, to want to know how they can engage on a very personal level with material that seems hugely complicated. You know, Merton's work can be very daunting. And I think, and Rumi was talking about religion, for example, and I think that's the same idea, that there are these things like religion that we hunger to engage with, to talk about, and yet we've made them very complicated and very big and very scary. So how do, this book is a way of getting us out into that field and say, hey, come on out. Let's just be out in the air and talk about these things in the way that we see it showing up in our lives, right? To look at our lives in a certain way and to realize there's something very simple here at work and we have only to see it and to trust it.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, in the ways that you speak about and talk to Thomas Merton, it seems like there are times when he comforts you or you seek to comfort him, and also times when there are challenges. You challenge him and he might challenge you. And I'm wondering if you could talk about those two things and how they work.
You know, Thomas Merton started journaling when he was a very young man. Even like teens, early 20s, he was journaling. So, and he journaled throughout his life. Like his last entries are just a day or two before he died. So I feel that I'm engaging with him at different ages. So there are times when he's younger than I am. Mm-hmm. And he reminds me of my son. Or sometimes he's a brash young man and he reminds me of one of my brothers, and I would call him to task just as I would my son or my brothers and say, you should know better, mm-hmm. right? But then there are times when we are the same age and I'm talking to him as I would a contemporary, where we are dealing with the same things. We are dealing with middle age. We are dealing with thinking about death approaching. So it's the reason that works, I think, is because he is so many different ages in the material that I'm reading.
Mm-hmm. To talk some about some current and not so current events, the first thing I want to ask you about is your son was at Sandy Hook the day of the terrible massacre. And I'm wondering how that has affected both of you spiritually, how it's affected your relationship, and also you talk some, and I would love to have you talk some more about the book that you wrote together.
Well, that book is actually the story of that, Liz. The book you're referencing is called This Child of Faith, Raising a Spiritual Child in a Secular World. Mm-hmm. And it's basically the story of our family joining the Episcopal Church when this was the year before Sandy Hook. And the journey of faith that we started on, and the things I learned from him about faith, even though he was so young. But it wasn't until Sandy Hook that I realized how deeply embedded his faith was and how it was supporting him in that dark time. And so he was expressing that all throughout in the years and months after that. So he was in a documentary called Midsummer in Newtown, where it was about a theater program that was created in the wake of the tragedy. And there's a part in the movie where the director asked Tane, and he was 9 at the time, he asked, what's the most important thing in your life? And he says, right away, he says, God. Mm. Surprised the director, surprised me. And when that film came out, a lot of people started asking me about his faith. And so that's what led us to write that book, mm-hmm. to talk about that journey. And I wanted him to write his own parts of the book, because to me, he is the sage, right? He has way more profound things to say than I do. So I knew that there'd be parts of the book. I showed him the outlines that I'm going to talk about these things. So you can just, you know, put your two cents in, and we will put that in the book as well.
You talk about your friend Spice, right? The man that you were really good friends with that you hadn't seen for a while, and in the church parking lot you saw him.
Yeah.
What I wonder about, and I wonder about this for myself too, you could call them serendipitous events that happen. I have them happen to me too, and I think you have to be open to them to recognize that something like that has happened to you. And how does, quote, coincidence, which I don't really believe in, but that kind of thing, how does that fit in with your personal spirituality in terms of the existence of God working in your life?
You know, I don't think of it as coincidence, you know, because it's not a matter of, oh, this person showed up because, oh, I was just thinking about you. No, someone showed up in a moment where I was in deep personal need, right? And I think the better example from the book is where I talk about my friend Jenny, how, you know, I mentioned my friend Katie mm-hmm. in that reading. Mm-hmm. You know, Katie did have cancer and Katie did eventually die. And there's a day I talk about in the book where I'm walking through Central Park, mourning her, feeling very in the depths of despair and trying to help myself feel better. And two things in my mind that I was thinking about that trying to give myself a little bit of joy, I'm thinking about tulips and I was thinking about how, oh, you know, I would love to see my friend Jenny, but yeah, you never run into Jenny because she lives in California and all of these different things. But not 10 minutes later, I run into Jenny and she takes me to a store and she gives me tulips without my asking for them, right? So a very specific thing mm-hmm. where I'm trying to make myself feel, I'm hurting, I'm really hurting. And the two things that I think might help me feel better show up. Now, you can't call that serendipity. You can't call that.
No.
Right?
No, it's so, not.
And the wonderful thing, Liz, is that I heard a story from someone reading this book who, it's like the book had made her aware to look for these things as well. Mm-hmm. So I'll explain. So I didn't see this Facebook post. Someone sent it to me, a Facebook post of a woman who is reading my book, and she's thinking about these experiences just that you're describing, and she's feeling envious. She's thinking, well, these things never happened to me. And she gets to the part in the prayer section where I'm talking about praying with icons. And I'm describing Merton's icons that he used, and I'm describing the ones that I have. So she decides to take an icon off of her shelf, her favorite icon, and she's holding it in her lap and she's continuing to read my book. She turns the page and she comes to a point where I'm quoting from the Gospel of John, the quote that talks about the Good Shepherd. And it's the quote I talk about after seeing my friend in the parking lot mm-hmm. about how, you know, I'm the Good Shepherd and you know, I will not, you know, let my sheep fall into harm. And she says in her Facebook post, for the rest of this story, see picture. And she shows you that the picture, the icon that she had taken off her shelf was the icon of the Good Shepherd. And she realizes that suddenly here she is envying me for these moments. And suddenly she had one of her own to show her, you know, this is not, you know, this is you too. This is not just some special, only other people have this experience. This is you too.
Right.
God is here for you too. Yeah. Right? So that's exciting that for people to just to realize that this isn't a special thing, that it is all of us, like that we are all connected in this way.
Yes, yes. I have a wonderful story that's too long to tell, but I will ask your permission to email it to you. It's about this, what we're talking about. And I would love to share it with you. It's just too long. I don't want to make this interview about me.
Please do. Send it to me. Yeah.
I would love to send it to you. I think you will be not surprised.
Okay.
Yeah. It was actually the moment I began to believe in God is what it is. So I will share that with you.
Okay.
A little bit different. You were a journalist, and I'm wondering, how did being a journalist while you were working and after you stopped affect your spiritual life?
Oh, goodness. You know, I think it's interesting. I think my spirituality, even though I didn't think of it as part of my job, I think it was just apparent, and I didn't realize it at first. I would do interviews. I would interview people, and they would tell me that it made them feel better somehow. They were like, I feel like I should pay you for that, right? And somehow it was just about me listening and just making a safe space for them. And I think, Liz, that, I don't know, I think eventually I don't think I could be a journalist now. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, you know, I probably could have been a better journalist then, but it's just that I really see people as people. And right now, stories are more like entertainment, and they're not like a person's story. And I'm not sure, I guess I'm not sure that I could, you know, have an engagement with someone, especially if it's, you know, if I felt that we got really personal. Mm-hmm. I can't go back to my office and write a story about that.
Yeah, makes sense. Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to take the rest of our time to talk about the current day situation with racial justice and Black Lives Matter and George Floyd. It's in terms of your conversations with Thomas Merton in those conversations, depending on what age he is, he had a different level of maturity about this. And I'm wondering if you could talk some about your changes and your feelings and what you got from Thomas Merton about that.
Well, he affirmed for me that I have to look after my own heart, right? And that's actually the purpose of nonviolence, right? Of studying nonviolence, of practicing nonviolence. It's so that, and we were talking about the open field earlier, mm-hmm. right? It's about being able to protect your heart so that you can participate in the open field, to not come from a place of hatred, right? You don't want someone else to make you into something that you're not, mm-hmm. which could very easily happen in the racial situation of, you know, it's easy to get angry. It's easy to get frustrated. I think the hard part is protecting your heart and being open to compassion. And Merton talked about that. And the reason I could hear him and believe in that is because he understood how much of it is a white problem, as he put it, mm-hmm. right? That there is such misunderstanding, and that it is so deep and embedded, and that he knew that and he felt that. And I think that that's what gave him credibility among so many civil rights workers, mm-hmm. And activists. So he affirmed that for me, and by connecting it to nonviolence, which was something, a piece that I didn't have, mm-hmm. he helped me to see not just how to struggle with it, but it's here's a way of thinking about it, mm-hmm. here's a way into that compassion and forgiveness.
You talk about compassion and forgiveness, and it makes me think of listening. And you do talk about listening in that section of the book too. This is going to be kind of an oxymoron, but very briefly, as we get ready to end the conversation, talk to us about listening.
You know, you have to listen not just to what's being said, but to what's not being said, right? So when you see someone acting out of a lot of anger and hatred, there's pain there too,
mm-hmm.
right? And I talked about this in one of my, in a video, you know, thinking about someone, for example, like the insurrection on January, in January, and thinking about some of those men who, like in Nancy Pelosi's office, that guy sitting at her desk, right? You're looking at someone who thinks in terms of value. And if he thinks in terms of value, then he must not think of himself as valuable. And if he gains such power from sitting in her chair, then he must not have power a lot in his own life. He needed to be in that chair. And I have to hear that and find some compassion for that person. Like, yeah. This is someone who's acting out of lack and loss.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. And so we won't get anywhere if I'm just addressing how horrible it is that he did this thing. That means I'm not hearing that this person needs something. And how do I hear that?
We need to listen.
It's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
It's not easy.
The hardest thing. Well, you know, the other hardest thing is that we've run out of time, Sophronia, and I just have enjoyed talking to you very, very much. This has been, your book brought my spirituality back into my mind. It had been gone for a while. And so it was a really wonderful experience. And it's been a wonderful experience to talk to you. And now I have to let you go. Thanks so much. You'll be hearing from me.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.